that have been sent out the way it was. It was started by a common, by Angola 3 supporter, Scott Crow. You know, it never would have happened without the Angola 3. And this is the reward that he get for saving this city and this area, is to die in a prison cell. You know, I mean, it's something that, it leave a bitter taste in my mouth.
Malik and Jackie, I want to thank you for being with us. Malik Rahim, one of the founders of Louisiana chapter of the Black Panther Party's new Herman Wallace in jail, and ended up running for Congress on the Green Party ticket. Jackie Sumel is building the house that Herman has dreamed of. Herman's House describes their collaboration on PBS POV. That does it for our broadcast. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Amy Littlefield, Dennis Moynihan, Sam Alkoff, Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Special thanks to the crew here also at WLAE, New Orleans Public Television.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is more talk radio with hosts Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. Today we'll hear the third in a series of programs looking at the Affordable Care Act, the new health insurance exchanges, and Cover Oregon. Today we'll look at unions and Taft-Hartley benefit plans. Our guests will be James McGee, the executive director of the Transit Employees Health and Welfare Fund, and Peter Shapiro, organizer of Portland Jobs with Justice.
KBOO was granted a license by the Federal Communications Commission to serve the public interest as a public trustee until February 1, 2014. Our license will expire on February 1, 2014. We filed an application for license renewal with the FCC. A copy of this application is available for public inspection during our regular business hours. It contains information concerning the station's performance since May 16, 2008. Individuals who wish to advise the FCC of facts relating to our renewal application and to whether the station has operated in the public interest should file comments and petitions with the Commission by January 2, 2014. Further information concerning the Commission's broadcast license renewal process is available at KBOO Studios at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214, or may be obtained from the FCC, Washington, D.C. 20554.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio in Corvallis at 104.3, in Hood River it's 91.9, and in Portland 90.7. On the World Wide Web, it is kboo.fm. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott, and I will be joined by my co-host, Celeste Carey. Today, we are continuing on a series of programs looking at the Affordable Care Act, the new health insurance exchanges, and its impact on all of us. In our previous programs, we looked at the Cover Oregon, the Health Insurance Exchanges Act, and we touched upon some quirks in the systems. Today, we hope to have a more extended conversation about the Affordable Care Act and its impact on programs on workers, particularly union workers. Joining us today will be Jim McGee, who is the Executive Director of the Transit Employees Health and Welfare Fund, and Peter Shapiro, who is an organizer with Portland Jobs with Justice. Let me give you our phone numbers so you may participate in our conversation. Our phone numbers are 503-231-8187, and you may also email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Again, 503-231-8187, and email at moretalkradio@gmail.com. as we wait to get Jim on the phone, I want to greet Peter, who's joining us again.
Howdy.
And I also want to thank Peter because he got out of a sick bed to join us this morning.
I do have insurance at this time. I just want to reassure everybody about that.
This is good to know. Peter, when you were on the program a couple of weeks ago, you shared with us some concerns or some issues about the Affordable Care Act, particularly its impact on labor, and that's what we want to focus on this morning. But first, let's say good morning to Celeste.
Good morning, all. And I heard that about the sick bed. And yes, insurance is a good thing. One of the things that I think will be really important to kind of flesh this out is to explain for people who are not familiar with the Taft-Hartley Act why that is significant, given the fact that the gist of the previous two programs was that even though it's not perfect, the Affordable Health Care Act does help a lot of people. Now, when we hear about the Affordable Care Act in relation to the Taft-Hartley Act, however, it seems like it seems like it's kind of switched a little bit, and there's some concerns, and that the fit is not as good as we would like.
You got Jim on the line, right?
Yes, we have Jim on the line, our expert.
Okay.
So this is my cue?
Yes, this is
your cue.
Hey, Jim.
Well, first off, thank you very much for having me on your show. The Taft-Hartley plans are kind of a unique animal. And one of the very different things about the Affordable Care Act, unlike any other piece of benefits legislation, is that no place in the Act does it specifically address issues that are unique to collectively bargained plans or to multi-employer plans. And understand that I use the term multi-employer plans and Taft-Hartley plans interchangeably. And the multi-employer plans are really unique, and it's unfortunate that they weren't actually used as a model for healthcare reform, because in many ways they address currently the issues that the Affordable Care Act attempts to address, which is they are a mechanism for providing continuity of coverage to the people who are seasonally employed or part-time employed or temporarily employed. And really, these are the people that the Affordable Care Act attempts to address. You will have a lot of small employers who contribute to multi-employer plans, and the idea, and just to give you an example, I am a member of Plumbers Local 520 in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I spent 12 years roughly working in the trade. During that time, I worked for about that many employers. I had periods of employment ranging from 5 days to 4 years. I had periods of unemployment or disability ranging from a couple of days to 6 months. I got married, had kids, and my health insurance was always there. I never had to think about it because my employers paid into the fund while I worked in order for me to have coverage during those periods of time when I didn't work. And this model has, over time, because of the cost of health care, has become increasingly put these employers at an increasingly competitive disadvantage. And what the funds hope to get out of the Affordable Care Act was a leveling of that competitive playing field so that their employers would compete on the same basis as the non-union employers. Well, what the Affordable Care Act did is it did two things. It didn't give them any of the benefits and made them pay the price. So while small employers are able to access tax credits through the exchanges, small employers that contribute to Taft-Hartley funds are not able to access those tax credits. And on the other hand, they have to pay fees and taxes to subsidize the exchange. So they're really instead of seeing the playing field leveled, they're seeing the playing field tilted against them.
I actually have a question, Jim. This is Peter. something I saw on the internet saying employers who offer, pointing out that employers who offer health coverage to their employees already get a federal tax write-off for it. Does that I would assume that applies to people who pay into a multi-employer fund as well.
Yes,
I was using that as an argument for like, well, they don't have a beef then as far as what you just described. How would you answer that?
Well, that is a probably a somewhat fair criticism, but it really doesn't do anything to level the playing field. Because this expense, when an employer buys health insurance, they're essentially buying on the exchange, they're buying it with that's a business expense and is a tax deduction already.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they're really getting the same kind of deduction that they there's no difference. I mean, in that sense, they both have access to the same deduction. So
it's a meaningless argument, in other words.
Right, it's a meaningless argument.
So what we're looking at then is the possibility that those employers, small or larger, and who are paying into this fund, the multiple employer fund, they see what looks like a viable option for them, which is don't pay, take their employees, possibly offer their insurance or decrease their hours or something that would allow them to not have to pay into that and not cover them, forcing employees to possibly go on the Affordable Health Care Act. Is that what we're looking at?
Well, that's another consequence of the Affordable Care Act. It's a little bit different than this particular impact. You know, you have employers who are really doing the math, and this is especially true for employers that have a high percentage of low-income workers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they will say, look, my employees earn 250% of poverty on average. And on average, they can buy, and I'm just picking numbers here, but they can buy health care on the exchange for $4,000. And I'm currently paying $10,000 for them. I can give them $4,000. I can gross up their income. I can pay the penalty. And I still come out ahead of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So that's you know, there were employers who were doing that math almost a day after the law was signed. So that's a very real consequence or possibility. And generally speaking, the employers who have done that math figure that the break-even point is somewhere around 250 to 300% of poverty. But the key there is average, and what works on average doesn't necessarily work out for every single employee. So there'll be some that will make out better than others, and some that will clearly lose, because the eligibility for subsidy is based on family income and not individual income.
You're listening to More Talk Radio with Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. Our guests this morning are Jim McGee, who is the Executive Director of the Transit Employees Health and Welfare Fund, and Peter Shapiro with Portland Jobs with Justice. We are talking about the impact of the Affordable Care Act on union workers and possible reforms to this law. Maybe a more general question as we delve more into the mechanics here of the problems of the act as it stands now. I suppose writing legislation is like someone saying, like creating sausage. It's messy and you don't want to find out about it. I understand that unions had some negotiations with the White House after the Affordable Care Act was passed. For some modification Can either you, Peter, or Jim tell us what happened with those negotiations, and is the White House open to modification?
Well, since I am not privy to those, I can't speak with authority. But I've know some people that have been closer to that scene than myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you saw, over the last year, with certain international union presidents speaking out against the Affordable Care Act, is a level of frustration with those negotiations, that they weren't going anywhere, that they weren't getting what they wanted out of them. And of course, that was sort of signed, sealed, and delivered with the letter from the Obama administration almost the Friday after the close of the AFL-CIO convention. Although that letter really only addressed one of the what I categorize as the three main complaints that are expressed in Resolution 54, which is the status of multi-employer plans vis-a-vis the exchanges.
I should break in, actually, at this point. Resolution 54 was passed by the National AFL-CIO Convention at the beginning of September, and it began with a reaffirmation of the AFL-CIO's continuing support for single payer as the ultimate solution to the healthcare crisis, or as they call it, the social insurance model. Pretty much the Taft-Hartley model that Jim just described writ large and applied to everybody, whereby, you know, no matter what your job status is, you'd still could count on coverage paid for by, you know, public funds. But the resolution went on to list a number of areas in which the Affordable Care Act actually undermines collective bargaining agreements, which do provide for health coverage, and it demanded fixes, which so far have not been forthcoming. Actually, the IBEW, the Electrical Workers Union, put out a white paper where they list four specific complaints about the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, a couple of which Jim has already referred to. One of them is that, and I think there's one complaint that it doesn't mention, which is a huge concern for me, which is that large employers who are required to pay to buy coverage for their employees or pay a fine, that doesn't apply if their employees are working less than 30 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
And we are seeing across the country some very big employers cutting their employees' hours back to 29 hours or 28 hours to avoid the fine. We're also seeing some large employers which have historically provided some kind of health coverage for their part-time workers, eliminating that coverage and saying, hey, you don't need us, you can get it on the insurance exchange. Whether what they get on the exchange is comparable to what they're getting now is an open question, I think. And I know that in Western Washington, the United Food and Commercial Workers have been, last week they were taking a strike vote for precisely this reason, that the big grocery chains have proposed a contract which would eliminate health coverage for part-time workers on the grounds that they can get it on the insurance exchange once it's installed.
And this is one of the things I think that is really distressing about this is the fact that, yes, you might be able to get some type of assistance if you are at that income level that will make you eligible for it. But we're still talking about out-of-pocket expenses, and we're still talking about the fact that they still may have reduced hours. And so that means that it's going to be higher. And then there are some folks who are purchasing their insurance through the exchange to find out that their rates do go up more than what they're paying previously. So given the fact that you've got these scenarios before us, what are some of the solutions that have been proposed, and where are we with those solutions? Are we moving forward? I did hear you say earlier, Jim, that, you know, you're not privy to some of these, but there was there've been some meetings and there's been some letters written. But with the vote coming up here in hours, what can we expect?
Well, I don't think that this is a political climate. This is just my personal opinion. Political climate that has shown, at least at the national level, any level of constructive discussion on any issue whatsoever.
You are the diplomat.
I just saw a blurb this morning. Came across. There's a lawsuit pending right now that has been brought up by two plaintiffs, arguing that the employers should not. Right now, a penalty, the employer penalty that Peter spoke of, only applies if an employee accesses subsidies on the exchange, which is one of the complaints that the AFL-CIO has. In addition to the hours thing, it's how that's applied. Well, what this lawsuit does is it alleges that the law specifically says state exchanges. So there's 34 states that have federal exchanges. So this lawsuit is making the argument that those 34 states, because they are not state exchanges as explicitly described in the law, they should be exempt from these employer penalties. Well, what's interesting is, from my perspective, is, you know, when you see a law this big and this complicated, it is very, very common to see what's called a Technical Corrections Act. You know, they go through after the fact and, you know, realize a couple of citations are wrong, a lot of unintended errors that are fixed in a Technical Corrections Act. Well, the political climate is such that you could never, even though the law passed the first time around, you're not going to get it passed the second time around. And it's just sad, to say the least.
So where do we go from here, considering the political climate nationally, and maybe also in some states? How are unions organizing in terms of reformation of this act, and how will you organize in such a way so it doesn't seem as if you are in line with Tea Party activists who are against any type of health care reform?
Well, I can I can point to one thing, an action taken yesterday by the state convention of the Oregon AFL-CIO. They voted almost unanimously to affiliate with Health Care for All Oregon, which is a statewide coalition that I work with, that Portland Jobs with Justice is a part of, which is working for a universal, publicly funded, accessible healthcare system for everybody, for everybody who lives in Oregon or the United States, for that matter, and the United States. We believe that ultimately we are going to have a national system set up, but in the meantime, we're prepared to work for change at the state level as well, if that's what it takes to get Congress off the dime. Vermont has already done this. And there are a lot of problems, I think, to try and implement a system like this at the state level, some of which actually involve Taft-Hartley Trust, because a lot of those trusts, they cross state lines. And if you pull people in a given state out of that trust, and the people in the states that don't have a state system set up remain in the trust, the trust is weakened. So I think one thing that we'll have to do when it comes time to passing legislation here in Oregon is we're going to have some language in the bill, and we're committed to doing this, that will provide the appropriate exemptions for people in Taft-Hartley Trust so that those trusts will not be undermined. To me, what's wrong with Obamacare is, you all remember when he was, you know, promoting the law, President Obama said, if you like the coverage you have, you can keep it.
Right.
This is to help people who don't have coverage. And the insurance exchange is not supposed to replace anybody, any existing health coverage. It wasn't supposed to. Yet, in fact, that's exactly what is happening in a whole host of situations where employers are dumping their coverage for their part-timers, or employers who never offered coverage in the first place are enjoying a competitive advantage over employers who do offer coverage. And not only just what existed before, but now they're getting federal subsidies to do it. And it really is weakening. It's making it that much tougher for unions to negotiate decent benefits for their workers. And that job has already been extremely tough. So I think it's for this reason that more and more unions are realizing we're really in an unsustainable situation here, and we're going to have to look for more drastic solutions than simply plugging the holes in the leaky dike of the healthcare system as it exists right now.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Jim McGee and Peter Shapiro. If you have questions about how your business can interact with the Affordable Health Care Act, any challenges you have as a union member, or anything else regarding working under the Multi-Employer Act, give us a call, 503-231-8187. What it sounds like we've got is pretty much a dismal situation. So we're all sitting here with relatively long faces, wondering how do we activate the proper response? What even is the proper response at this point? We've talked about the coalitions of unions and organizations like Jobs with Justice coming together and not only making the move in terms of trying to influence the legislative process, but in terms of informing both the employers and employees the benefits of a modified act, if nothing else. And then you just said, well, you know, with the political climate as it is now, we're not even sure we're going to be able to move forward with this because for whatever reason, it's still viewed as plugging holes. So how do we kind of turn this around? As I'm listening, it sounds just a little dismal.
Well, let me just say this. You know, I don't take such a dismal view of the whole situation. I think with the Affordable Care Act, in many respects, we've crossed the Rubicon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what has the Republicans so apoplectic. They just are totally, totally beside themselves that people could actually be able to do something as simple as buy insurance. I mean, really, that is what the Affordable Care Act is at its most basic level.
Well, Jim, let me ask this.
Opening up opportunity. And to suggest that we could roll back to a point where people have to demonstrate insurability in order to demonstrate that they're healthy in order to get health insurance, or to roll back lifetime maximums, or to roll back coverage to age 26, I just don't think the American people are going to buy that.
Well, is it also the fact that we're just this much closer to what many conservatives consider subsidized or socialized medicine, and that's what's got veins popping?
I don't agree with that at all. And I'll tell you why.
Neither do I.
I mean, where the basic model, this is why I think the Republicans' behavior in Congress is so hypocritical.
Uh-huh.
The basic model for the Affordable Care Act, which is that compulsory health insurance, it originated with a Heritage Foundation
that we all know. But
you know, it was first instituted with bipartisan support in Massachusetts under Governor Mitt Romney.
Right.
It began as a Republican idea.
It doesn't stop them from recharacterizing it. And that's what we hear, because one of the things we've been trying to address is the fact that there's so many, and I'm not going to call it disinformation, just lies out there. So, you know, and this is the one thing that is really dishonest, I think, about a lot of the conservative mindset when it comes to looking after the welfare of the union, is that anytime you have anything like Social Security, you have unemployment options, you have Medicare, you have health care coverage, period, you see the conservatives spinning around as if rich people don't get the same kind of care, as if there aren't other benefits to come out of the government larder, if you will, that everybody else is getting, you know, that's hypocritical. I get you, but it's just the fact that they characterize it that way, and it keeps getting into people's heads, and I'm just a little flummoxed because, like you, the sheer hypocrisy of it just kind of has me stymied.
Well, no need to be stymied. I think it can spur us to, you know, to further action.
Okay. Well, let's see what further action our callers have in mind or what questions they have. Good morning, Sean.
Hey, good morning. As a supporter of socialized medicine, I'd really like to I'd really like to challenge the step in the right direction dogma. It just blew my mind to see Michael Moore come out when Obamacare was passed and say that, and he said that this is a step in the right direction. That just rocks my world, because to me this is so transparently a privatization scheme. Medicare is taking a huge cut, and we're getting a so-called public-private partnership. That's got to be the most grotesque phrase that's come into popularity lately. Mm-hmm. I see this as, you know, like you guys were just talking about it, the Heritage Foundation, Romney Care. This is the Koch brothers. This is the capture of the Democratic Party by the Koch brothers Democratic Leadership Council. And I'm just beside myself to see this privatization scheme, you know, even getting this far. Thanks.
Well, don't hang up yet.
I don't know if I would characterize the Affordable Care Act as a privatization scheme. I think, you know, privatization of Medicare is a serious problem, and it's been going on a lot longer than this. I mean, it really accelerated under the Bush administration, but that's not really related to the Affordable Care Act. We already have a privatized health insurance system for people who are not eligible for Medicare. The Affordable Care Act makes an attempt to regulate it a little bit more and at the same time make it a little bit more profitable for the insurance industry. It's a trade-off. You can interpret that any way you want to. And personally, I share the caller's basic sympathies myself, but I don't think you need to support socialized medicine to support a universal publicly funded healthcare system.
But doesn't the Affordable Care Act expand government assistance for those who, 138 of the poverty level?
Yeah, I mean, it offers subsidies to people who can't afford insurance, and basically those are subsidies of the insurance industry. Because, you know, I think I said this when I was on a couple of weeks ago, that really the insurance industry was in danger of pricing itself out of the market. It was selling a product that nobody could afford anymore. So Uncle Sam steps in and say, hey, we will pay people, we'll pick up some of the tab for people to buy your product, and that way you'll get a new lease on life, you'll get 30 million new customers or whatever. And in return, though, you have to accept some regulations that were not enforced before. You're going to have to take some people onto your rolls who have pre-existing conditions. You're going to have to keep their kids on your policy a little bit longer. You have to spend at least 80% of the money you shell out on actually paying doctors, you know, instead of insurance or dividends or whatever. Now, that's a we can get into a long discussion about how effective that last provision is, but the principle, I think, is a sound one. I mean, in the past, any insurance company that spent as much as 80% on actually paying doctor bills would see its stock, the value of its stock, take a nosedive.
No matter how ethical that was to make that payment.
I mean, forget ethics. We're talking business here.
Yeah. Well, see, and one of the things that frustrates me, and we'll go to the next caller, is what you said, though, what you just illustrated is the whole point that I'm making about everybody's getting subsidies. Because basically what we did is we offered to bail out the insurance agencies, the insurance companies and corporations, and make a pittance toward insuring the populace. And that's one of the things that kind of blows my mind when we talk about some of the hypocrisy that we see coming out of this the House legislators and their vitriol against it is that, well, but we're still paying your folks. They're getting a subsidy, you know?
Well, I think there's, you know, you have to face up to some political realities.
Well, yeah.
It's clear the single-payer folks like Peter and myself didn't have the muscle to be heard at the table, as they say, when this whole discussion was going on. It's also clear that this was driven by the insurance companies to keep their own market from imploding, and it's a reflection of the poor level of discourse, I guess you could say, that it took so much to achieve so little.
Yes.
You know, that's no reason for giving up hope. I think the Trojan horse, and this is in the Affordable Care Act that I think is to the long-term detriment, is the underlying assumption that health care is an individual responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is like retirement security is an individual responsibility. We went from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans, shifting the burden of financing individual retirement to the individual. I think that's a really dangerous direction to be headed. And I think the Affordable Care Act really undermines kind of the group solidarity that is inherent in collectively bargained plans and multi-employer plans. In a lot of ways, it breaks up employer groups. It breaks up family units. I mean, there's disincentives now. I was just reading recently about how in the last 3 years, there's been a quadrupling of employers that are offering disincentives. The last bargaining unit here has a disincentive for spousal coverage. So you're going to see families with the employee on the employer plan and the spouse having to shop for own coverage.
Yes.
It's just a dangerous direction to be going, I think.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey. You just heard Jim McGee, who is the executive director of the Transit Employees Health and Welfare Fund, which provides health and welfare benefits to approximately 11,000 active and retired members of ATU Local 689, employed by the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. And also joining us is Peter Shapiro with Portland Jobs with Justice. We invite your calls for questions about the Affordable Care Act, how it might be modified. And
what to do if you are a union member and you have concerns, how to negotiate. Good morning, Marie.
Good morning, everyone. I have one kind of powerful question, and I don't know too much in detail. You might know more, Mr. McGee, our host. This is a real person, their story, and it's very short. A person recounted to me, who is a Hispanic orchard worker in our area, that they had two different employers because they had both were, to get the 40 hours, so they had to have two employments. And they had an injury, and each of the employers claimed that it happened on the other job, so neither employer would help with that injury. So I thought I'd just throw that out, and I'll get off to hear your guys' answer. Thank you very much.
Wow.
Well, Marie, I really feel for that employee. There's a lot of people who blame insurance companies for all our ills, but even though I'm employed in this business and have been for 30 years, the real culprit in this whole system is this idea of employment-based health care coverage.
Yes.
And I think the example here is illustrative of that. I had a member in our office a while back, and he claimed to have hurt himself on the job. Was off work, but because the employer disputed whether it was a job-related injury, he got no compensation. Because he got no compensation, he couldn't afford health care insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So now think about this scenario for a second. Here's an employee who can't get his body part fixed because essentially the right hand, his employer-based coverage, is arguing with his left hand, his employer-based workers' compensation coverage.
Mm-hmm.
This makes absolutely no sense. Healthcare should, and because they're having this silly argument, this otherwise productive worker has been sitting at home for 6 months. And this is the absurdity of this employment-based system, that the worker that Marie describes should not be able to get her issue resolved. Who cares whether it's work-related? Who cares whether it's work-related? Ultimately, I mean, this concept is probably a little bit controversial within the labor movement, I know, but get her fixed and back to work.
You know, this is interesting, I think, in light of, I know we've got another caller on the line, but this is interesting in light of what the first caller, point the first caller made. I think given the kind of situation we live in, we absolutely could not afford to do without the workers' compensation, the workers' compensation law. Mm-hmm. If you get hurt on the job, you're entitled to be taken care of. I would not want to see that law disappear until we have a universal system that the sort that Jim described, where it isn't necessary anymore. But as long as we don't have that kind of system, we do need a workers' comp.
Things is kind of confusing about this whole mix is that you've got people saying that having the insurance coverage based on employment rather than the employee is a good idea. And I'm looking at a quote from John. It looks like John Molis, who's the president of the Oregon Building Trades Council, and so he's commenting on the dangerous dynamic that comes with having multiple employers considering whether they want to continue paying into the trust to cover employees that are seasonal or construction or laborers, as opposed to letting them purchase their insurance through the Affordable Health Care Act. So when you've got that sentiment, who's thinking that it's good that it's tied to employment, how does that protect the employee who maybe could end up like either scenario from our caller Marie or the one that you mentioned, Jim?
Well, to get back to the question that you asked earlier, you know, kind of where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. I am of the opinion that we shouldn't waste political capital trying to fix the Affordable Care Act,
mm-hmm.
that we should move as quickly as possible to some kind of single-payer system, either at the state level or the national level. I don't think that the issues related to state single-payer, as far as they impact multi-employer plans, are as insurmountable. Mm-hmm. I think the multi-employer plans will be well-positioned to offer supplemental benefits and offer negotiated lower rates for in-state residents who are working. They're going to have some issues around reciprocal agreements that not going to be easy to work out, but not that they couldn't be worked out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's kind of where we need to go.
So you're looking at constructing a plan that's going to leapfrog this, something ready to implement when the current act expires.
2017, actually, DIS gives mm-hmm. state, the Affordable Care Act says states that can come up with a better mousetrap are entitled to use it if the Department of Health and Human Services approves it.
And so that's our boomer of hope.
So that's 2017, I think, is the day. And I can't predict the future. My sense is that there are going to be a lot of problems with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. I think people are going to want to keep what's positive about it, but they're also going to find that it's simply a model that doesn't work over the long haul. It just has too many problems, and we're going to have to demand something better. And I'm hopeful that that will happen.
So perhaps as I hear all of you speaking, since it seems to be impossible to have any effective legislation on the national level, the action will revert back to the state. And maybe that's where we will find models and the push for real alternatives such as single payer. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. We have a caller online. So let's go to...
Good morning, Vernon.
Vernon?
This is a good discussion.
Oh, okay, there we are.
I'd like to go back to the time that the Affordable Care Act was passed. And remind you that at that time, the Democrats had the control of both houses of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
They had the White House. There was a proposal on the table for single payer, and it was widely popular.
Yes.
They could have passed it. But the Democratic leadership chose to give us this compromise, and we still have a national health care system that is not even as good as what Zambia has. I mean, most of the world has much better single-payer system.
Well, it's a little better than Zambia, you know. We don't have malaria, but I hear you. I hear you. I hear you.
So what I'm saying is, if people are upset that we don't have the single-payer system that we certainly deserve, we need to put it in the lap of the Democratic Party. And the most effective thing that a person can do right now is change your registration from Democrat to Green. If enough of us do that, they will get the message.
I want to do a shout-out, though, to one Democrat who did support the single-payer legislation that Bernie Sanders put forward before Congress. That's Senator Jeff Merkley.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been staunch on this. And I think there are Democrats in Congress who have fought very hard for single-payer. John Conyers has been doing it for years. Whether you opt for the third-party strategy or not, I think, is a decision everybody has to make for themselves. Don't want to make a blanket condemnation of congressional Democrats, because there are some good ones out there, and Merkley is one of them.
And I would, every year. I mean, we had Dennis Kucinich was the great champion of single-payer, and, of course, he was defeated by a well-funded Democrat.
Well, we're going to keep Merkley in office if we can. At least I intend to.
Jim, you were saying?
Yeah, but even before you get to the vote on single-payer, you have the issue of filibuster and reform, which Senator Merkley has also been involved with. And I think the reluctance of the parties to deal with that in a meaningful way, I think, is why we have the impasse. On
filibuster is a rule that could be changed by majority vote. And, you know, I mean, back in the good old days when the parties threatened to filibuster, they made them filibuster. Go ahead, talk all night. And then they passed it by majority as soon as, eventually it all works. The filibuster has become a straw horse. In my opinion.
Okay, well, thank you for realigning us to the points.
It's good talking to you.
Uh-huh.
I'm out of here.
So what I'm hearing, Jim, to part the clouds and get the light in here, and I also hear you saying it, Peter, is to focus on organizing within our state or states, since you're in Washington, to come up with a plan that will address the deficits of the Affordable Health Care Act and then continue to protect seasonal workers and those covered by the Taft-Hartley Act, and to not give up hope, but to look at this as, I guess we'll call it the proving grounds.
That's the way I'd look at it. I mean, I think you look at every shortcoming, every injustice as an organizing opportunity and a chance to point it out. I mean, it's funny when what's that insurance company that just got over the rights to rename the Rose Garden?
Mm-hmm.
The Oregonian has been, which has become a really wretched excuse for a newspaper in the last couple of years, in my opinion. But it's been almost impossible to get any real good letter to the editor published lately on the subject of healthcare. They printed a whole page of letters of people who were just enraged. It says, I've got insurance with this outfit. They keep raising my rates, and this is what they're spending money on, is the right to trumpet their name on the Rose Garden.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what gives? Why are these people even responsible for our healthcare? I mean, it raises a lot of questions in people's minds, and we just have to go out and talk about this stuff to folks. I do think that logic and time and justice are on our side. And I think to the extent that there's any democracy left in this country, sooner or later, our voices are going to be heard. We just have to get up and demand it.
So
I presume that you all heard the story about in Kentucky, where the exchange there was out marketing their efforts at the state fair. And this gentleman came up and they was telling him all about the...
Uh-oh.
Hello?
Hi.
Uh-oh. Did we lose him? Okay, our engineer is going to try and get him back. And
shoot, I wanted to hear
I wanted to hear that, too. Well, in the meantime, a couple of questions here. For individuals who are covered by the Taft-Hartley Act, how can they get some... Plan. How can they get more information that can help them navigate getting adequate coverage through either their employer and the act or through the insurance exchange if it comes to that for them?
Well, I would think that anybody who's covered by a Taft-Hartley plan would want to stay in it.
Mm-hmm. Assuming that they get to keep the amount of hours they need.
Well, I think the question of lower hours, it's not... I think the big, I mean, Jim can talk more knowledgeably about this than I can, but my sense is that, I guess, in the grocery industry, I know they have some Taft-Hartley plan. You got him back good. Mm-hmm. Have him answer the question.
No, okay.
I'm just sort of winging it here.
Okay. Jim, first we want you to finish the story. We missed the end. Okay. Our engineers.
Buddy.
Okay, there we go. We got you back now.
Yeah, this gentleman comes up to the table for Connect Care, they call it, and is really intrigued, signs up, and then turns to his buddy and says, "Boy, this sure is a whole lot better than Obamacare."
Bless his heart.
Misinformation.
Bless his heart. Well, so one of the questions that I was asking, and Peter was being gracious and trying to fill it in, is you've got employers and employees, rather, who are covered through the Taft-Hartley plan. Is there any issues that they need to consider while making sure that they're covered by insurance? Is there any possibility that they need to consider being covered by the Oregon Care plan, or are they secure where they are?
Well, I think different funds will feel different pressures. Not all the Taft-Hartley plans can be looked at identical.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them will have, I won't say an easier time, but fewer difficulties than others. But, you know, I was at the International Foundation. Those in the multi-employer world were familiar with the International Foundation of Employee Benefit Plans. At a session a couple months ago, and they had two speakers, both of them were at the table in these negotiations with the White House and the administration. I don't know about specifically the White House, but certainly the administration. And they both predicted a very bleak future long term for multi-employer plans, which is why I think the goal in a multi-employer plan, you know, one of the tragedies in this whole model, you know, there's been a lot of in the wonk world discussion about churn in the Affordable Care Act and how people will be moving from one plan to another.
Right.
Well, the multi-employer plans address that. You know, they address it very effectively, and it's so tragic to see that model just be jeopardized through the Affordable Care Act. But the real solution to healthcare security and transitional care is the kind of plan that Peter and Sean, the first caller, mentioned, which is a plan that has universal coverage, no questions asked, and provides that coverage. And that kind of continuity of care that I enjoyed as a pipe fitter 30 years ago, 20 years ago, is becoming increasingly rare because it's becoming increasingly difficult to afford.
I think I do want to weigh in here because I know a few years ago Senator Ron Wyden was pushing something called the Healthy Americans Act, and he got up there and he made a lot of the same arguments against job-based coverage that we've made this morning. But the thing is, his solution was to have everybody buy their own insurance and have the insurance industry just sort of be made more affordable. I think the long-term tendency of Obamacare is going to be to do the same thing. It's going to make it tougher and tougher for unions to negotiate benefits for their workers through their jobs, and it's going to shove more and more people out under the private insurance market, where presumably they'll have some kind of government subsidies or protection, but they'll still basically be on their own. And you know, when Wyden made his proposal, Jobs as Justice, I mean, we picketed his office a few times. We shouted a lot of nasty slogans at him. And basically, the gist of it is, you can't replace something with nothing, which is what Wyden proposed to do, I think. And I don't mince words when I talk about him on health care. He's good on some other issues, but on health care, I think he's been terrible. You cannot, until we have a true universal publicly funded system, we're going to need those union negotiated plans. We're going to need some kind of pressure on employers to provide coverage for their employees, because God knows the employees cannot afford it on their own. Nobody can. And there's no way in hell the government can subsidize everybody who's unable to pay the cost of their insurance, because it's just too expensive. You would reduce the cost of insurance. You would reduce the cost of covering people by something like 30% if we went over to a public system.
Mm-hmm.
The waste that's built into the private insurance system is phenomenal, and it's not just insurance companies raking off a lot of extra money. It's the burden that's placed on healthcare providers who have to spend, you know, 30% of their overhead haggling with claims adjusters, or the hospitals who build these big elaborate facilities. And then, you know, I mean, I could go on for 45 minutes mm-hmm. on this. The point is that you've got a market-driven system. And we have to. That's what we have to change.
So Jim, how do? Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Jim, we're running short of time, so we want to make sure that you have the last word. So your thoughts or reflections as we close this phase of our conversation.
Well, I would just like to echo Peter's sentiments twofold, but also point out that one of the things that the Affordable Care Act has enabled is private exchanges. The fact that the Affordable Care Act has established what's called guaranteed issue, that anybody, regardless of medical conditions, can get insurance, and the fact that the Affordable Care Act has established what's called essential health benefits, which has kind of leveled the benefit variability within plans, these have enabled these private exchanges. And if you read the literature on this, this is clearly a mechanism for employers to move their employees into a defined contribution model for coverage, and they're designed to provide continuity of coverage at full price, but you know, through periods of unemployment. So this idea of individual responsibility, I think, is the real Trojan horse in the Affordable Care Act.
So how do we get people organized so that they can come together and start building the new plan? Because I've heard you both talk about the hope that lies in us creating a system that's going to work state level and statewide.
And we have 1 minute.
Yes.
Well, those of you who are in Portland who want to get involved in this, especially folks involved in the labor movement, you're welcome to come to the Healthcare Committee of Jobs with Justice. We meet on the third Thursday of the month at 6 o'clock at the Oregon Nurses, Oregon Federation of Nurses office on the fifth floor, I believe, 1500 Northeast Irving. You're welcome to come. We will find a way to put you to work. We need everybody. You can support Healthcare for All Oregon, the statewide coalition. They've got a great website, hcao.org. Look it up.
And thank you, Peter. And thank you, Jim, for joining us this morning and for your work. And keep on pushing for reform.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
My solution is more radio programs like this one.
Okay, well, we'll keep you on speed dial.
Thank you. So coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 is the OMO with discussions on Syria, the Affordable Health Care Act, the government shutdown, food stamps, class, and more. At 10 is Air Cascadia, news and headlines with Chris Andre. 10:15, Locus Focus features a conversation with author Richard Heinberg, author of Snake Oil. It's about fracking, false promise of plenty. At 11 on Health and Healthcare, Roberta Hall speaks with chiropractor lobbyist Vern Taboe about recent progress in expanding public health care reform to offer what has been called alternative care. Thank you, KBOO members. All of you who participated in the book and record sale this weekend. And if you're not a member, please do so by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. I'm Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey, and you are our community here at your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscasts. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. The time is 8:59. Up next, the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Friends of KABU, supporting locally produced, organically grown, homemade programming for Portland and the world. Thanks, KABU, for 45 years of music, current affairs, and live broadcasts. This program has also been made possible in part by a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the KABU Monthly Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM, where it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We call this show The Old Mole after Karl Marx's image of the revolution that works underground, invisible to the official version of life put out by the mainstream media and politicians, but which, like a mole in the manicured corporate lawn, suddenly pops up where least expected, aiming to change the course of history, to bring visible power to the 99% of the people who before had merely seemed powerless. The Old Mole Collective puts on this show every week here on KBOO to support and encourage those who work for radical change in the power relations that give so much to the wealthiest and so little to the rest of us. I'm Clayton Morgridge, your host for today. Our engineer is Joe Clement. On today's Old Mole, we'll be focusing on what our tax-supported governments are doing and failing to do to make our lives and our world better. Will our military intervene in Syria?